This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Donald Trump takes television ratings seriously. He has for years, especially with The Apprentice. But this week, he lost a minor ratings battle with his political opponents. About 43 million people watched the president's first primetime address from the Oval Office this week. 28% of all televisions in the nation tuned in. In broadcast industry terms, that is called a 28 rating. But the Democratic response scored a 29.3 rating. But the only number much of the public really cares about, though, is 800,000. That is the number of federal workers who are going without paychecks as of today. We will talk about the political and personal impact on our nation as the shutdown continues today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us in studio is Jeff Mason, a White House correspondent for Reuters. Jeff, welcome back to the Roundup.
Good to be with you, Joshua.
Alexis Simondinger is a national political correspondent with The Hill. Welcome, Alexis.
It's great to see you.
And Jonathan Tamari is a Washington correspondent with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We welcome your questions and thoughts and your stories on how the shutdown is affecting you. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream or tweet us at 1A. President Trump spent about 10 minutes explaining his strategy for border security in that first ever Oval Office address of his administration. That included his argument for a $5 billion steel fence, which he claims Democrats used to be cool with. After the speech, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer got their chance at a rebuttal. Alexis, let me start with you. I think the thing that stood out to me the most about the address and the rebuttal was that nothing stood out. They both made the exact same cases they've been making for months now. Is it safe to say that we didn't learn anything from these addresses?
Well, I think you just underscore what we did learn, right? Which was that we didn't hear any news about what would replace the shutdown or how to get out of the shutdown. What we heard was the lengths to which the Democrats and the Republicans led by President Trump were dug in. And that continued all this week. And, you know, it looks like we're going to see the president continue to do discussion today. He's got more meetings at the White House scheduled to showcase his perspective. We know the Vice President Pence is going to do something along the same lines by going to the Department of Homeland Security. And leading into the weekend, we do not see any talks. We did not see the week end with any real serious give or take in the way of negotiations.
Jonathan, is there any sense that the needle moved in any direction as a result of this? I mean, we mentioned that slightly more people watched the Democratic response than the president's speech, although to be fair, that varied from network to network. On Fox News, I believe they were about on par. On some of the networks, it was like 3% more. So it wasn't vastly different. But do we have any sense that these two addresses move the needle at all in any direction?
No, I mean, it's been a weird week where there's been a lot of activity. We've had Oval Office address, rebuttal, president visiting the border, the House is continuing to vote on things, there's negotiations, the president came to Capitol Hill, and none of it really moved the ball an inch. We're pretty much in the same place we were when everybody got back from New Year's, dug in on the same positions and the same talking points.
I do want to talk more about that border visit in just a minute. But as we said, it's been a busy few days since that address, even though that address didn't really seem to move the needle very much. President Trump had a meeting with Democratic leaders that, according to Chuck Schumer, did not go that well.
He asked Speaker Pelosi, "Will you agree to my wall?" She said, "No." And he just got up and said, "Then we have nothing to discuss," and he just walked out.
Now, contrast that with what the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said. He claimed that Schumer had mischaracterized the meeting, although McCarthy's version of events was pretty similar.
He didn't slam the table. He just said, "Well, it doesn't seem like this is productive," and simply walked out while we continued to talk.
That was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy speaking on Fox News Wednesday. So, Jeff Mason, it seems like both sides are pretty much agreed that the meeting didn't go far. Whether the president slammed the table or not seems immaterial in a way. I mean, where does this leave us?
Well, I think the salient point there is that he walked out. And that's because nothing was happening. And where does it leave us? It leaves us in the middle, again, of a standstill on this shutdown that is now into its 21st day at a time when 800,000 government workers are either furloughed or not getting paychecks. Not getting paychecks today, by the way. It's beginning to hurt. And that can't be good for the Republicans or the Democrats, but neither side, particularly the White House, is showing signs that they're going to budge.
We are speaking to Jeff Mason of Reuters, Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill, and Jonathan Tamari of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We welcome your questions or comments about any of the big stories from this week's news or your accounts of how this shutdown is affecting you. Some of the images of what people have had to deal with from the shutdown are pretty stark, as well as the impact on, say, some of our national parks and federal lands, this kind of grievous environmental damage that's been done because the people who are supposed to be watching these parks are off the job. Tell us how the shutdown is showing up for you or in your life, or share any of your questions or thoughts about any of the other stories that made news this week, 1A@WAMU.org. By the way, it's worth noting the president's account of that meeting. Here's what he tweeted this week. He wrote, quote, "Crying Chuck," referring to Chuck Schumer, "Crying Chuck told his favorite lie when he used his standard soundbite that I slammed the table and walked out of the room. He had a temper tantrum. Because I knew he would say that, and after Nancy said no to proper border security, I politely said bye-bye and left. No slamming." So he said bye-bye, Alexis. At least he was nice about it. But the larger thing he has not been nice about is the potential of declaring a national emergency. He has said that he has the absolute right to do that. Some people thought he would do that on Tuesday. Where does that piece of all this stand?
Well, where we are this morning is that the president has given every indication in interviews, publicly on tweets, that he believes that his attorneys have given him 100% assurance. I'm putting quote marks around 100% because there's lots of dispute in the legal community about this, that he has the right to do this and then would move forward and be able to begin to build more of the wall. What's interesting about this is that while there is legal dispute about whether the president has the authority to do this, whether it would be challenged in court, what would happen, there seem to be some Democrats that I know that all of our news organizations have encountered this week at the end that are almost eager for the president to go this direction and then meet him in court. In other words, there seems to be some bipartisan desire to let the courts settle this element of it if it is the off-ramp to ending the shutdown, and then move on to the debate and the argument about where the money comes from and whether there will be a wall and what should happen to the Department of Homeland Security. And that is an interesting development that we haven't seen mature yet, but we may see that happen.
So, Jonathan, some Democrats are eager for this so that it can play out in court. What about Republicans on Capitol Hill? How are they holding up?
So they're sticking with the president by and large. There are a few who have broken with him, but not really enough to create a ton of pressure on other Republicans at this point. And when it comes to the him declaring an emergency, it's interesting. A lot of Republicans are saying they don't think he should go that route. They, you know, they are traditionally the party of limited government, and they also are just protective of Congress's powers as opposed to the executive's powers. But I don't get the impression either that even if they say he shouldn't do that, that they would necessarily do anything to stop him. Because like Democrats, I think they're looking for a way out of this and a way to move on to other things. And this would basically throw it into the courts and really bring it back as a political issue again in 2020 when the president would say, listen, you know, you need to reelect me to get the wall. And Democrats would be able to see stopping or defeating him as a way to stop the wall.
Yeah, Jeff, the president's really been kind of the negotiator in chief on this throughout, including his trip yesterday to the southern border where he spoke to Border Patrol agents. He has made a lot of claims about the border, including that 4,000 immigrants in the FBI's terrorism database have been intercepted there. That claim is dubious at best, not the least of which reason being that according to the government's own figures, most of the people who are interdicted for concerns about terrorism or suspicion are caught at airports or regular ports of entry, as opposed to something more coarse like the border. You are parts of the border that don't have actual formal ports of entry. Jeff, you went with the president on his trip to the southern border. How did that go?
Well, I think from the White House's perspective, it went well. It was largely a trip about imagery, and he got a lot of imagery out of it. He went down to the border after having had a briefing beforehand, and there was a Black Hawk helicopter that flew by. He waved or saluted at the people in the helicopter. He got a chance to look over the border, look at the Rio Grande, speak to other Border Patrol members who he says support his push for a wall. And I will tell you that we spoke to some people people down there too as part of the pool, and had it explained why they supported a wall. So it's not wrong to say by the president that there are people in the law enforcement community and on the Border Patrol who believe that that is absolutely the right policy. Then he did his interview with Sean Hannity and had pictures taken and engaged with us, with the press, about his policy and what he wants, and doing it all with that backdrop.
Let me get to a quick question before we have to pause. Christina tweeted, if Congress controls the purse strings anyhow, why can't they circumvent the White House and put people back to work? Alexis, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the reason for this is Mitch McConnell, that he won't bring a bill to the Senate floor unless he is convinced that the president will sign it.
That's right. And I think you've highlighted the key thing, which is that lawmakers need the president to sign the legislation and the appropriations that they approve. And what Mitch McConnell is saying is that as long as the president is not apt to approve that legislation, he is not interested in getting his conference to vote in that direction. So he's taking his cues from the president, and it's part of the reason why he himself has retreated into the shadows and let the president sort of take the walk the point on this argument.
Isabel tweeted, it's really McConnell's shutdown. If the House and Senate pass a bill and Trump vetoes it, they can override. Time for Congress to earn their money. We'll continue with the Friday News Roundup in just a moment with Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill, Jonathan Tamari of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Jeff Mason of Reuters. There have been a lot of false claims that have bounced around in this immigration debate. I wonder if you have any greatest hits that you think need to be debunked. I'd like to go around the table and see what each of you think the public really needs to know is just not true when we continue with the Roundup in just a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you on this Friday. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup on the 21st day of this federal government shutdown. We're joined by Jonathan Tamari, a Washington correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Alexis Simmendinger, national political correspondent for The Hill, and Reuters White House correspondent Jeff Mason. We welcome your questions, thoughts, and stories about this shutdown or about any of the other headlines that caught your attention this week. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Kelly tweeted, DC's sanitation department and our local tax dollars are paying to clean up the National Mall, even as our region is disproportionately affected by the shutdown and while we are denied equal representation in Congress. Hashtag taxation without representation. We'll talk more about the local impacts of the shutdown in just a moment, but let's get to some more of your questions about the shutdown. Ellen is listening in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ellen asks, does that 800,000 number of federal employees refer to federal contract workers too? I don't think it does. I think the impact on contractors, Jonathan, is bigger than that.
Yeah, I believe that those are actual people who work directly for the federal government. Some of them are not working at all, and some of them are working without pay.
And that question goes to the fact that there are knock-on effects. I mean, there are these hundreds of thousands of government workers not getting a paycheck today, but there are lots and lots of other people who have contracts, who are working in neighborhoods, working in communities with federal government workers who are feeling the effects of this shutdown very acutely as well.
And then just to follow up on that, the Senate passed a bill unanimously yesterday to pay the federal workers who are not getting paid right now, to give them back pay when this is all over. But it's not clear if that's going to extend to those contractors. They might not be made whole.
Ben had a question for you, Jeff. Ben tweeted, how has this long, drawn-out fight over the wall and the shutdown seemed to affect the morale and the cohesion at the White House?
That's a great question. I think that you can see it in the fact, my answer to that is they're doubling down. And you've seen the president double down by his actions this week with those remarks from the Oval Office, with his trip yesterday to the border, with his general demeanor and his answers to our questions about what he wants to do about the wall. The president does sort of double down when he feels under pressure. So I wouldn't dispute that he probably feels some pressure right now. But his response so far has been to say, I'm doing the right thing. My job is to protect the security of the United States. This is a security and a humanitarian issue.
I would imagine also, Jeff, that based on the president's history these last 2 years, if there were major players who were turning out to look like cracks in the armor, they wouldn't be part of the administration for very long.
No. I mean, I think if we're looking for cracks in the armor, I would look over at my colleagues here at the table and in terms of the folks on the Hill that you cover. That's where the cracks are likely to show.
Alexis, are there any people in particular that the White House is most concerned about? I mean, we've heard from a few senators, I think, like, maybe we need to find some other way. But I wonder from your perspective if it really feels like a crack at this point or just senators, lawmakers trying to sound level-headed.
Well, it's a mixed question, so I'll give you a mixed answer. And that is that the president is very aware, very acutely, as Jeff is suggesting, who it is who's most animated about the wall, his base. And he got most animated about this when Laura Ingraham or the talk radio,
Rush Limbaugh,
when they were animated and concerned that the president was abandoning his pledge because he was seemingly poised to sign a continuing resolution and to fight another day, keep the government operating. So that is foremost in the president's mind. When Jeff is talking about the pressure, that is absolutely, the president feels that pressure. But the element of what's going on the Hill or politically speaking, the president's also very aware. And he's depending on the leadership in the House and the Senate, Republican leaders. It's the reason he went to the Hill, because he understood that the cracks were emerging, but they were from more centrist Republican senators, or those who are facing re-election in 2020. And he felt that, look, you know, I'm going to go give them a pep talk and tell them why it's so important that we stand together. Otherwise, our party is destroyed. And Lindsey Graham has said the same thing. Back up the president or our party will be destroyed.
Mitchell wrote on our Facebook page, what happened to the art of the deal? The president could offer a deal on DACA to get wall funding. Stacy tweeted, can you discuss the deal last year where Trump would get some money for the wall and there would be a resolution for the DACA kids? Trump originally agreed to it and then did not, I think. Is Stacy right? Is that how that went down? And is that deal dead or could that come back?
Well, the fact that that deal fell apart and the prospective Democrats is, yeah, they thought that there was some kind of arrangement that was going to go forward with an exchange of even more border wall money that they're talking about now, much more than the $5 billion in exchange for a solution to DACA. But when that deal fell apart, Democrats have become very skeptical of now dealing with the president. They're afraid that if they go out and make a deal that he'll then move the goalposts, and now they're on the hook for supporting $5 or $10 billion, and then he'll say, well, you've already agreed to that, now I want more. So that deal is off. And yesterday, in fact, there were discussions about bringing back some kind of trade-off along those lines, and Vice President Pence, I believe, took that off the table as well. So
no wall, no deal.
Yeah.
Also, the president seems to have indicated that in his mind, the DACA question should be settled by the U.S. Supreme Court and not necessarily by any action that he takes in addition to actually removing the DACA program and then having the courts extend it again.
Is there anybody who has a political incentive to solve this? It feels like, I know, don't make me more cynical than I already am. Damn it, Washington. It seems like there's no one who has an incentive to say, hold it, I will be the grown-up in the room, calm down, okay, so I can fix this. Jeff, there is no one, and it's amazing to me, there is no one at all in our entire national political landscape, except maybe locals, who are seeing the impact of the shutdown locally. No one in the Beltway who seems to have a political advantage to be gained by solving this. Everyone seems to have an advantage to be cemented by continuing to double down.
And yet both sides should. I mean, I think this could potentially hurt both in the end. The question for all of these shutdowns ends up being who's really going to get the blame? And we've seen in previous shutdowns who gets it, and then that has political ramifications going forward. I think now that we're past the New Year's holiday, now that we're on the day when the first set of government checks are not going out, we might start to see more reflection of who's getting the blame. The polls that I have seen show that most Americans are giving more blame to the president than they are to the Democrats. That said, there are, as Alexis was rightly referring to, still a lot of supporters in his base who are delighted to see him drawing a line in the sand over the wall.
I want to get to some more of the impacts of the shutdown in just a minute, but I do want to do a little fact-checking here. We mentioned the president went to the border yesterday. Here is the president repeating one of his frequently made claims about the funding of the border wall. Listen.
When I say Mexico is going to pay for the wall, that's what I said. Mexico is going to pay. I didn't say they're going to write me a check for $20 billion or $10 billion. No one's going to write a check. I said they're going to pay for the wall. And if Congress approves this incredible trade bill that we made with Mexico and Canada, by the way, but with Mexico in this case, they're paying for the wall many, many times over.
Part of the president's remarks to reporters at the border yesterday. Now, I think the president is right in saying it wouldn't be a check. Maybe a wire transfer, but probably not a personal check. But, Jeff, that is simply not true on a number of levels.
You asked for a greatest hits right before the break, and I was going to put this at the top of the greatest hits in terms of untruth. That is a piece of verbal and mathematical gymnastics that has been absolutely debunked. That's not how trade deals work, number one. Number one. Number two, I think if you went back in time and asked supporters at those rallies that President Trump was speaking at, where he absolutely got people excited about the fact that not only would he build the wall, but it would be funded by Mexico, they would have been expecting Mexico to be footing the bill. And that's not through a trade deal that, by the way, has not been passed or approved yet by Congress.
Well, and I'm glad you made the distinction. There's a signing of the deal, but then the three nations involved, you know, Canada's parliament, Mexico's National Assembly, and the U.S. Congress, still each have to ratify that deal among themselves for it to take effect.
That's correct.
Any other greatest hits that are worth debunking, Alexis, Jonathan, Alexis?
Well, the one that sticks out in addition to...
And I should say by either the Trump administration or Democrats,
sure.
Greatest hits.
Yes. In the case of President Trump continuing to focus on some of his remarks, one of the things that it was a little startling, I think, is the contradictions. One of the things that he offered up was that 800,000 federal workers affected, that's mostly Democrats, he said, so that he somehow dismissed them as being, you know, part of this argument. But then he contradicted himself by saying most of the federal workers who are affected support this. And so you can't have both things be the same. And of course, 800,000 federal workers nationwide affected are not all Democrats.
Jonathan, any greatest hits to debunk?
And this one, I'll give credit to NBC News. They reported this out. The administration has put out a number of 4,000 people, suspected terrorists, being blocked from entering the United States. That's fiscal year 2017. As a sign of why we need this wall. But then when NBC dug into these numbers, it turned out that there were six of those people were actually stopped at the southern border who were non-U.S. citizens. So that 4,000 is not at all commensurate with the number of non-citizens actually being stopped at the border.
Mindy wrote on our Facebook page, while I don't support the wall at all, at what point do we try to negotiate somehow? I believe in taking a stand, but when we are on day 20 of my husband not getting a paycheck from the Coast Guard and we have three daughters, it makes it a little more difficult to take a stand. It's beginning to feel hopeless. Mindy is spot on in terms of the human impact of this partial government shutdown, because a lot of the federal workers have been going quite a while without the guarantee of a paycheck, and for many people, today would have been payday. Our colleague here at WAMU, Patrick Madden, spoke with a woman at a rally for federal workers and their supporters on Wednesday night in Silver Spring, Maryland, which is just outside the district line, just northeast of Washington. Here is what Michelle had to say.
I show up to work. I do a good job. I'm doing everything a responsible adult is supposed to do. And all of a sudden, it's all blowing up, and I don't know what else to do.
Michelle, who didn't want to give her full name for fear of repercussions, says she can't believe she's in this position.
This is the first time in my working life I am going to have to go to my creditors and say, I don't know how to pay you. And it's embarrassing.
That was WAMU's Patrick Madden reporting. Do we have any sense of how these workers are coping, whether there's anything that these federal agencies are doing to help their employees cope, or are they just kind of on their own?
Well, one of the more uncomfortable things that has occurred in the last 2 weeks, I think, is to watch the federal government try to be helpful by telling people, for instance, who work for the government and serve the government, have a garage sale. Or here's a letter that you can write to try to ask your landlord to maybe give you some grace period. That kind of outreach is very sad and has disturbed a lot of federal workers who maybe were a little slow to believe that this would extend this long. and thought that this would be over earlier than this. But you can see the range of options that even the federal government. In the District of Columbia, for instance, as you were suggesting, the mayor has reached out and tried to say, we'll backfill what the federal government is not doing. One of the counties right outside of Washington in Maryland is trying to put together a website to help federal workers that work in, this is Prince George's County. So you can see that there are adaptations, at all levels of government.
And there are a number of local municipalities, D.C., for example, picking up trash. San Francisco had also been picking up some trash on federal land called Land's End, which is part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which I believe is the largest national recreation area in the Park Service, because it's the trash cans were overflowing and the park had just become kind of disgusting, and they were tired of waiting for federal employees to be able to clean it up. There are also food stamp funds running low, concerns about how well airports will function, although I've never seen people so nice to TSA agents ever in my life. Please be nice. We're traveling tomorrow, so please be nice to your TSA agents. How are some of these federal agencies doing without funds, without support? I mean, are they able to find other funds, emergency funds, or have they just kind of flung up their hands, Jonathan, and said, well, sorry, we can't do anything?
I mean, in some cases they have. I believe that they were trying to find some way to move around money at the park services to try to clean up some of these parks and address some of these issues. But, I mean, they're operating with less staff, with limited funding, and even these solutions that they find, they're stopgaps. They're only going to last so long. So, they're doing what they can, but the resources are really limited, and so is what they're able to provide.
Is that kind of the political push, Jeff, that ends this shutdown when enough people say enough is enough? Or is this really in the president's hands to end?
Well, it's certainly in the president's hands to end, although you can't disclaim the fact that the Democrats could also cave. They have that option, but as we've been saying for the whole program, I don't see any side doing that. But at the end of the day, I think to your question, Joshua, I think that the pressure of looking at what's happening in these parks, listening to people like the listener that you just read her tweet from, people are suffering. Genuinely suffering because of this. And at some point, the politicians who are responsible for it will have to hear those voices.
It's interesting. One interesting thing about this week, and it's not I can't say it's a good thing that's come out of the shutdown, but it's just kind of an illuminating thing. It's interesting to me how many pieces of the federal government we don't know there are until they stop working.
For sure.
Like Southwest Airlines was planning on starting flights to Hawaii, and now they can't, because the federal inspectors who would have approved the routes are furloughed by the shutdown. Or there are breweries that are trying to sell new beers, and they can't get the labels from the government that would approve the beers being sold because of the shutdown. It's almost like you don't realize how big and how essential the federal government is until it stops working.
Which is how you would theoretically want it to work, right? You usually only hear about them when something's really gone wrong.
Exactly. And clearly something has really gone wrong, including for a lot of you who shared your stories with us. Thank you for being willing to tell these stories. We know they're embarrassing, and we know that at times they're really shameful to share, but your courage in sharing them means a lot. So to everyone who's been willing to talk, thank you.
And
the nation needs to hear
and
this.
And it has an impact. It definitely has a political impact. So keep talking.
Please do keep talking. We're going to continue to share your stories. Feel free over the weekend to leave us a voicemail anytime, 855-236-1A1A. We are traveling this weekend. We will be very nice to TSA on our way out of Dulles to LAX. We'll be visiting KPCC in Los Angeles. So if you're on the West Coast, or if you know someone in California who is affected by this shutdown, please be in touch, 855-236-1A1A. Plenty more we want to discuss, including something that aired on 60 Minutes this past Sunday, an interview between Anderson Cooper and freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's part of that interview.
The president certainly didn't invent racism, but he's certainly given a voice to it and expanded it and created a platform for those things.
Do you believe President Trump is a racist?
Yeah, no question.
How can you say that?
When you look at the words that he uses, which are historic dog whistles of white supremacy, when you look at how he reacted to the Charlottesville incident where neo-Nazis murdered a woman versus how he manufactures crises like immigrants seeking legal refuge on our borders, it's night and day.
part of the 60 Minutes interview between Anderson Cooper and freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We'll discuss that a little bit as we continue the roundup. We'll also talk about the controversial documentary that's led Chance the Rapper and Lady Gaga to issue public apologies this week. Those stories and more of your comments ahead. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill, Jeff Mason of Reuters, and Jonathan Tamari of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories, 1A at WAMU.org. So we played that clip from Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez from her interview on 60 Minutes on Sunday. She has really been getting a lot of attention.
You
in
think?
This, a little bit. But she started getting attention before she got elected. She won that primary night. And I remember a reporter came up to her and said, "Can you describe how you're feeling right now?" And she said, "Nope." And she was just friendly and perky and an internet native and just likable. And Jonathan, I wonder if that maybe is why she's getting so much attention, because she's likable in a way that the GOP does not like. And she's likable, I think, in a way that the Democratic kind of mainstream is a little concerned about.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing to watch play out, because inside the Capitol, she's a freshman congresswoman without a lot of clout, without seniority. You know, she tried to lead a rebellion against a set of rules that Democrats passed, and it really didn't go anywhere. Outside of the Capitol, she has this huge following on social media. She has a lot of fans who kind of look to her almost for cues of kind of what issues they want to take and how far they want to push the Democratic Party. You know, I was writing about a congressman from our area who's been in Congress for decades now. He's Frank Pallone. He's going to chair the Energy and Commerce Committee. He'll have major oversight over environmental issues. And he's been known as a really liberal environmentalist for decades now. Well, you know, he doesn't go as far as she does, and he's now getting heat for not being quite as far on board with the Green New Deal as she is. So she has this power outside of the Capitol that, and it'll be interesting, I guess, just to see whether she's able to bring that to bear actually on legislation and where the Democratic caucus goes. Because there's a lot of moderate members who certainly don't want to go as far as she did and who really flipped the House for Democrats.
And that's kind of what I'm wondering, Jeff Mason, is whether or not the concern over members like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Rashida Tlaib of Michigan is that they're acting as kind of the id of the Democratic Party. That a lot of things that some Democratic lawmakers and a number of Democratic voters are thinking, they say out loud.
I love that you use the word id.
Oh, yes.
That's nice.
Absolutely.
I think you probably hit the nail on the head right there. I mean, it's certainly going to create some pressure and some problems for Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. And we've seen already her trying to respond to that and keep people in line while also not tamping down free speech and not trying to encourage her members not to express themselves. But for sure, the two lawmakers that you just mentioned are giving voice to what a lot of people, certainly on the progressive side of the Democratic Party, think and feel. And they're enjoying seeing somebody as articulate and as sharp as the now so-called AOC is being and is giving voice to.
Before I get to some of your comments about AOC, Alexis, I wonder if that's also part of the threat, is that if members like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib might be speaking as the id of the Democratic Party, the last person who spoke as the id of the Republican Party became the President of the United States.
Yeah, and I was thinking, Jeff was on this trip, so I'll be interested in what he can add to this. But I was really paying attention when President Trump yesterday started to warm up more assertively his 2020 message about the Democratic field. He knows that that presidential field will be very large. And we're not talking about AOC running for president, but he is really creating a basket of progressives as far left as he can put them in together. And he started saying they're crazy. I really think they're crazy. And he's really enjoying this idea that he can cast them all in the same net with the same brush, whether it's Bernie Sanders or whether he wants to talk about Cortez Ocasio-Cortez or any of them. He's really creating a message that we're going to watch other Republicans follow.
Let me get to some of your comments about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. John wrote on our Facebook page, I like the upset that AOC is causing everyone. If you're making everyone mad, you just may be onto something. Catherine responded, it seems like the more the right attacks her, the more popular she becomes with even mainstream Dems. It reminds me of how media coverage of Trump delights his rabid base and causes otherwise reasonable Republicans to dig in their heels and support him. Patricia wrote on our Facebook page, she works for the people. We aren't fans. We are constituents. And MK Says Things tweeted, AOC is getting attention because the Democrats are super spineless and don't speak their values. She's likable because she's honest about what she prioritizes. Also, with regards to the new Congress, which is led by House Democrats, they've put forward one of their first big pieces of legislation. It's a bill that would expand background checks on people who want to purchase firearms. Now, House Democrats are making this bill a priority. Can you give us a sense of what's in the bill, what it would entail, and what its political future might look like, Jonathan?
So this is essentially their vehicle for trying to expand background checks to virtually all gun purchases. And they've managed to get a few Republicans on board in the House, folks from moderate districts, places like New Jersey, just outside Philadelphia. And there's a good chance they'll put this up for vote and try to move it through the House because it's been so long since any gun legislation has actually cleared either chamber, anything tightening gun laws anyway. But I don't think it has a very difficult road, at least in the Senate, where you still have a Republican majority. Even when there was a Democratic majority, they were unable to get a background check bill through. So there would have to be immense pressure on some of these Republicans in swing seats, and it's not clear that there are actually enough of them that would even be gettable to get a bill like that. And I'm not sure that Mitch McConnell would want to put his members in that situation where they're either going to anger the gun rights groups or anger the kind of suburban voters who support this.
Plenty also to talk about this week with regards to investigations surrounding President Trump and his inner circle, both related to Russia and otherwise. Michael Cohen, who's President Trump's former personal lawyer, will testify in February before the House Oversight and Reform Committee, testify openly in public. Cohen implicated President Trump in a scheme to pay hush money to two women who've claimed to have had affairs with Mr. Trump. We will all be watching that hearing very, very closely. You think the streets of D.C. are quiet now? Wait till everybody is huddled inside watching a television, watching the hearing. Also, the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, will reportedly leave the Department of Justice voluntarily after a new Attorney General is confirmed. The President's pick for AG, Mr. William Barr, will have confirmation hearings next week. Jeff Mason, what would all of this mean if Rod Rosenstein leaves? He's been overseeing the Russia investigation. William Barr comes in. You have Matthew Whitaker, the interim Attorney General right now. What would this transition potentially mean for the Russia investigation?
Well, good question. Number one, Whitaker would presumably leave when his successor is confirmed. Rosenstein leaving means that sort of central figure who's been overlooking this probe would be gone as well. And so if he did leave, that would mean, for at least from his perspective, he would be giving a vote of confidence to the new Attorney General Barr to sort of trust and overlook or oversee this investigation and make sure that it is given the credence that it requires. However, I think it's worth noting, NBC also reported that Rosenstein was going to stay until Bob Mueller, the special prosecutor, submits his report. And that could be months. So sort of a little bit of some dispute there about when he might actually step down. And if he did stay, that would suggest that trust is not there for the new Attorney General to look over
that investigation. But either way, if Bill Barr is confirmed, and there's every reason to imagine that would happen with the Senate, William Barr takes over the supervision of the Mueller probe. In other words, Rod Rosenstein was only in charge of that because Jeff Sessions had recused himself. Right. So no matter what happens, if we have a new attorney general, that individual, and we anticipate it would be Bill Barr, would then be a supervisor of the Mueller probe. So whether Rod Rosenstein stays or not, he gets out of the Russia business.
A few other developments with regard to Russia investigations. On Tuesday, federal prosecutors in New York charged Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya with obstruction of justice. She was accused of trying to thwart an earlier investigation into money laundering that involved an influential Russian businessman. We also learned this week that Paul Manafort shared polling data with Russians during the 2016 campaign. Now, there have been
With Ukrainians with Russian connections.
Okay, so can you give us some context for why that matters? There are so many moving parts in this investigation. Is the Paul Manafort revelation pursuant to accusing him of another crime or of clarifying the crimes he's already committed or just painting him as a bad person? Like, what does this mean in the larger context?
Well, I think in the larger context, it's even less about Paul Manafort and more about the question of, was the Trump campaign or people involved in the Trump campaign actively coordinating with Russia? And the theory, and we don't know that it went this far, but the theory is if he was giving over, if Russians were targeting Americans, some internal polling data would be very helpful to them to try to understand how to target the messages that they were sending. Now, it's not clear exactly what he shared with them, exactly what information went there, but that would be one of the strongest connections yet known publicly if it turned out that he was sharing internal polling that was used to target people.
There are two stories from the world of entertainment that we wanted to finish on. One very serious that's gotten a lot of people's attention. I do want to get to a few more comments about the shutdown, though. Jada tweeted, if Trump declares a state of emergency to build his wall, Republicans need to remember that a Democrat will be president again. Robin asked, if Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico think the wall is a bad idea, why is that not enough to stop it? They know what the real situation is. Are there any states that have any particular leverage in this?
Well, all the border states do. But one thing that I think is important to add is it's not that the states are opposed to it by itself. What they're saying is this is not the only thing that we need for border security. So it's more a question of what priorities the different either officials in those states or in their delegations are backing. And so we can see the argument is not build a wall or not build a wall because there's 700 miles of wall already.
Right.
So this is a discussion about where resources need to go or politics, whichever you choose.
We should shift gears to a story from the world of music that's got the whole country talking. Georgia is reportedly investigating R&B singer R. Kelly after the Lifetime documentary Surviving R. Kelly. The six-part series details alleged abuse that spans about 30 years, beginning with his marriage to the pop star Aaliyah. At the time, he was 27 and she was 15. Now, a number of celebrities have spoken out since this series began airing. Lady Gaga collaborated with R. Kelly on a song called Do What You Want With My Body. She released a statement announcing that the song's been removed from streaming services, and she wrote, quote, I'm sorry both for my poor judgment when I was young and for not speaking out sooner, unquote. Protesters have also gathered outside R. Kelly's studio in Chicago, calling for music platforms to remove his work. I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that this story is moving, and not only that it's moving so quickly now, but that it's taken so long to move, Jeff. I mean, not only R. Kelly in the music industry, you see Congress beginning to reckon with the way that sexual harassment investigations are being done on Capitol Hill, with who has to pay for it, with who can be held accountable for it. It feels like there's this gigantic sea change that's been a long time in coming, and now it's here.
For sure. And I mean, and this one in particular comes from the ramifications of a documentary of just telling that story and getting that story out there. I think it's important to note R. Kelly's attorney said in response to Lady Gaga's statement that he had not committed any crime and accused her of using the controversy to generate buzz for her Oscar bid. So that aside, they're denying that he's this alleged misconduct, but it is absolutely hitting a lot of people and affecting a lot of people, both in the entertainment world and as we've certainly seen in Washington and the political world as well.
Do we get the sense, though, that there will be consequences? I mean, you know, R. Kelly is accused of having preyed on underage girls, but the actual consequential part of this, it seems, has been kind of slow in coming, not just in music, but in Congress and in the entertainment industry and so on.
Well, we have seen, I mean, it's hard to say, obviously, in the specific case of R. Kelly, what investigators will find and what evidence is available years later. But I think we have seen in general that there have started to be consequences in the form of lawmakers who have had to resign, executives at media companies who have had to resign, you know, people have lost advertising, commercial support. And it is becoming, it has been a long time coming, and it's kind of slowly rippling through these different sectors. But as it reaches each one, there seems to be a recognition that there needed to be stronger responses in the past, and people are responding now to what they can, to do what they can now.
One last story that I think Jeff's going to have to recuse himself from, because you told me during a break you didn't watch The Sopranos.
Should never have revealed that. I want to watch it. I didn't watch
it. Well, TV shows like Breaking Bad, The Wire, they owe a lot to The Sopranos. And it debuted 20 years ago this week. The Sopranos came out on January 10th, 1999. The adventures of Tony Soprano, his mob, and his family aired for six seasons with one of the most watched, most memorable finales in television history. Well, this week, the creator of The Sopranos, David Chase, got together with the cast to reminisce. Chase told the New York Times that he didn't quite understand the impact the show would have when it was on the air. And if you're still debating that controversial final episode, the final shot in the final episode, we may finally have some clarity. The last time we saw Tony and his family, they were sitting on that diner, Don't Stop Believin' was playing, then the song cuts off and the screen cuts to black. Chase says he calls that scene the death scene. But he dodged questions about whether that meant that Tony got killed in the restaurant. So if you would prefer to believe that Tony Soprano is still alive, don't stop. Do you buy that explanation?
Well, David Chase has talked about this before, and one of the things that he has said is that he wanted to send the message that life is great and we should all not stop believing, but life ends, that we will all die. And so he has this kind of combo of uplifting gloom.
Jonathan, I see you biting your tongue.
Well,
or biting your lip.
You know, I said this actually. You know, I grew up a couple towns over from where Tony Soprano fictionally lived, and so when that show came out, I was not in New Jersey, and I was like legitimately homesick, like seeing the scenes, like the way people talked, the way people dressed, like it really hit home. So I had actually not heard that part, that quote from David Chase. I mean, I think I was already in the Tony got killed camp, so I'll just use that to bolster my
total
pre-existing
spoiler.
Believing.
This has been a total spoiler.
You missed six seasons. It's long since spoiled.
20 Jonathan, years, yeah. Spoiler alerts are done after 20 years.
Jonathan Tamari of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Jeff Mason of Reuters, and Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill, thank you all for being with us.
Fade to black.
1A's lead engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the 1A.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we will see you Monday from Los Angeles. This is 1A.